amazing set of stories in the book of Exodus that takes us out of bondage and slavery, takes us to Mount Sinai, where we receive this great covenant gift from God, His instruction, and His word given at Mount Sinai. But then there's the big divorce at the Golden Calf incident. The people tried to create and fashion their own representation of the Most High. And so it's as if the people are rejecting the Lord. And you understand when you read God's perception, when He's in that conversation with Moses in chapter 33, that God takes it as a marriage breaker. God says, okay, if they want something else, I'll let them go their own way. I'm still going to have a people. I'll start over with you, Moses. And Moses intercedes. Marriage must be maintained, Moses argues. And God changes His mind and re-embraces Israel. Moses keeps pushing God to the point God finally says, okay, and I will not divorce the people. God hates divorce, particularly when it comes to His relationship with Am Yisrael, with His relationship with Israel. So there then has to be a new transaction, a new dowry that is given to reconnect the people with God. What is it that brings the people back into relationship with God? In Exodus chapter 30, we're told at the beginning of Ki Tisa, and it also comes up in this week's Torah portion, it's that collection, that half shekel that the people bring in order to, actually in chapter 30, we learned that it has to do with eventually counting the people. But the people bring a half shekel. It's not much. In fact, we're told that if you're rich, you bring a half shekel. If you're poor, you bring a half shekel. It's not like the free will offerings. It's different. We talked about those last week. The gold, the silver, the yarn, the wool, the people who carry in their beams of acacia wood that they just happen to have laying around, I guess. We talked about that in Torah study. But this is separate. This is different. This is not just offering from those that are willing or those whose heart draw them, but this is from everyone. A half shekel of silver from everyone. We're even told in this week's Parsha that the total amount added up to 100 talents of silver. 100 talents of silver. It's just and a little bit more, we're told. To put that in comparison, in the book of Esther, we're told that Haman... Oh, we're going to have to really work on this for the next couple of weeks. We're told that he offered the king an immense sum of money in order to do away with the Jews. Haman offered the king... Is that a moo or a boo? He offered the king 10,000... talents of silver. 10,000. from all of Israel, they collect 100. I'll have to figure out sometime what that ratio is, but that's like a 1% or something of everything that was offered in another case to do away with Israel. Israel brings together a half shekel per person, and what is that silver used for? That silver is used for the building of the tabernacle. That silver is what is made into little posts or brackets that hold the wood slats of the tabernacle. So I don't know how they were made. We're not told in Torah, but they were must have been little things that the wood plank sat in. And so all the silver from all the people, 100 talents worth, which if you have a nice footnote, that might explain to you how much that weighed. But together, it's all collected and brought to the Most High. It's interesting that it goes into that it unites the people. Their gifts are joined together, and it goes as a gift to beautify, to make the tabernacle, to make their worship special and beautiful. It's interesting that this week's Haftorah portion picks up this very idea of the shekel that was to be brought to the Most High. By the way, this week is a special Sabbath. Do you guys like special holidays? Sabbath is the most important holiday, we're told in the Leviticus chapter 23. It is the first of the holidays that God gave to Jewish people to observe. And in the Kaddish blessing on Friday nights, it repeats this idea. It is the first of all the holy days. It was the first. Remember, even in the Ten Commandments, it was the first day that God told them about. Even right after they left Egypt, God instructed them about the Sabbath for the first time. Throughout the year, there are certain times when the Haftorah reading deviates from the Torah portion. And this is one of those days. Actually, about a third of the time. Usually, you've been told, I've told you even, that the Haftorah portion, the reading from the prophets, mirrors the reading of the Torah portion. It is connected, but there are certain times, on certain days, at certain times of the year, that the Haftorah portion does not connect necessarily with the Torah portion. And this is one of those days. This today is called the Sabbath of Shekels, the Shekel Sabbath. Shabbat Shkalim. Shabbat Shkalim, the plural of shekel. Can you say Shkalim? Okay, that was weak, but that's okay. In the Haftorah portion, it is 2 Kings chapter 12. We have the story of a young boy who becomes a king. He was 7 years old. His mother was a daughter of Ahab. Do you guys remember Ahab and Jezebel? We learned a little bit about them in the Haftorah portion a couple weeks ago when Elijah had that big confrontation up on Mount Carmel with Ahab and Jezebel and their their horde of no good Nick prophets. The Ahab's daughter ends up marrying one of the kings of Judah. Gasp. It turns out that when the king died, Ahab's daughter assumes the throne. For 7 years, she reigns over Judah, and in order to consolidate her reign, do you know what she does? Do you guys know this story? Shalom. Baruch haba. Siyantate. Do you know what she does? She kills all the male heirs of the descendants of Jehoshaphat. She just kills them all. I guess some of them would have been her own children. In order to consolidate her kingdom. I guess if she had been successful, that means the line, God's promise to David that you would always have a king on the throne, that would have been it. It would have been over. But you know what happened? There was a wonderful priest who hid a newborn infant, hid him away. The priest and his wife lived in and spent a lot of time even in the tabernacle, we're told, or in the temple, rather, and they hid this little boy until he was 7 years old. And Yoash, or Yehoash, or Joash, or however you choose to pronounce it, is brought out when he is 7 years old. This evil woman, Ahab's daughter, has been on the throne for those 7 years. And there is a revolution, a coup, in the end, well, the lady's deposed. You can read the story and get the details if you like action stories. Man, the best stories are right there in the Tanakh. Yehoash begins a process of bringing restoration to the temple. The temple has stood for about 120 years by this point, and there's fallen into disarray. Every year, the people bring their half shekel, because that half shekel that was instituted in the book of Exodus becomes a yearly due. Every person, both the rich to the poor, once a year owes a half shekel to the maintenance of the temple. In the book of Exodus, it was for the maintenance, for building those silver posts that supported the construction of the tabernacle. And so this continues into the first temple period after Solomon's temple is built. It turns out that the priests are actually diverting the funds for other purposes. And after a number of years, Yehoash gets on their case and says, "Hey guys, look." It's basically what he says. He says, "You're diverting this money. The temple needs repair already. So I want you to go out and collect the half shekels in order for the maintenance and the upkeep of the temple." And so they go out and do it. So this is the Haftorah reading for Shabbat Shkalim, the Sabbath of Shekels. By the way, leading up to the first of Nisan, which is coming up in about a month, Nisan in this case is not the car I drive, but it is the first of the Hebrew months, month number one. And between now and the first of Nisan, there are four of these special Sabbaths. We're prepared for the first month, the first of the year, by four special Sabbaths. And this is the first one. The first one is collecting the half shekel. Collecting the half shekel, which, by the way, you can bring in 2 weeks so that we can make a donation to that children's home I told you about. All right? Okay, so that's just the commercial. So, year after year, this process of collecting the half shekel continued through the first temple period, and it also continued into the second temple period. But I want to go back a little bit and talk more about what this half shekel was all about. I tried to argue at the beginning, I tried to set up this thing, that the gift of the half shekel was a re-covenant kind of gift to reestablish relationship with the Most High back in the wilderness when Israel went after that golden calf. God told Moses, now I want the people to bring a dowry, is how I interpreted it. I want the people to bring a gift to bring them back into relationship with the Most High. How can I argue this? And somebody's going to say, well, it doesn't say that in the text. But give me a second and let me explain my midrash, okay? The Hebrew word that is used in this week's Torah portion for the half shekel is a Hebrew word, beka. Beka. It is bet kolf ayin. And it's used in Exodus chapter 38 for the half shekel that the people bring for those silver posts. They end up collecting 100 talents from all 600,000 of Israel. There is only one other place in all the Tanakh, in all the Hebrew scriptures, that word beka is used. And this is where I get the idea of marriage and relationship. It's used in Genesis chapter 24. Genesis chapter 24 is in a lovely story where Abraham sends his servant Eliezer to the old country. Go get a wife for my son. And so Eliezer goes to the old country and finds this really wonderful, kind, attractive young woman named Rivka. And Eliezer brings her, or asks her to water, give him some water. And he is prayed and asked God to lead him to the right woman. And so he sees a girl. And he thinks, oh, she's cute. And so he says, but just being cute isn't enough. Is she kind? Is this really the girl? Remember that, guys. Just being cute isn't enough. And so, does she have the qualities that mirror the Most High? So he asked her, would you give me a drink of water? That's pretty easy. And so she does. But you know what she does? She says, oh yeah, I'll give you a drink of water and let me water your entire herd of camels as well. You know, that's like, that's not just polite. She's not just being polite. She is like oozing with kindness. And he goes, wow, God, you answered that prayer really quick. And so he brings something to her, a gift, a dowry. He brings her a ring. He gives her a gold ring. And do you know how much it weighs? A beka. Absolutely. It weighs a half shekel. And she runs off to her family and says, "Hey, I've met somebody that's from, you know, cousin Avraham's family. And he wants me to go marry my cousin." And perhaps you know the rest of the story. The marriage agreement gift that she receives is a half shekel of gold. What did God receive from every person in Israel after the golden calf incident? God received a half shekel. Each Israeli brought God a silver amount of one beka, a half shekel, to restore the relationship. So thus, I'm in a midrashic way connecting the two stories. What Israel does is what Eliezer initiates with Rivka, initiates a relationship, a covenant, an enduring legacy. And so when Israel brings God, also, in like manner, they bring God a half shekel. They are engaging and entering into a relationship, a covenant, an enduring legacy. Isn't that beautiful? I think that is so amazingly beautiful. Okay. Well, if you don't think so, let me pour some richness on this. Matityahu chapter 17, Matthew chapter 17, tells a story that is about that this very thing, about the collection, the annual collection of the half shekel. Year after year, people would continue to give this half shekel to the maintenance of the temple. By the way, just a little background. The Romans were in control of the land, Eretz Israel, at the time of Yeshua, usually Rome did not allow the local provinces to collect taxes for their own purposes. Usually the taxes that were collected all went to the establishment and maintenance of the Roman bureaucracy. But Rome allowed Israel, the Jews, to continue this practice of collecting the half shekel. One of the few instances that Rome did that. Of course, they used that to their advantage after the year 70 CE when the temple was destroyed. By Titus, the Romans then said, "Oh, well, you've been collecting this half shekel tax. Well, you just need to keep on sending that, this time to us, so that we can maintain. If you want to maintain a temple, we have one in Rome. We have a temple to Jupiter. You can now maintain it." And so Rome imposed that tax, and it was like another stinky way that they stuck it to the Jews, as if they needed another one. There were certain people, though, that at the time of Yeshua were exempt. For instance, the rabbis were exempt from the half shekel tax. The poor were exempt. Some people refused to pay it, like the Sadducees or the Essene community, who are perhaps the community that produced the Dead Sea Scrolls. They simply refused to pay it. But generally people would pay this temple tax. So this sets up the story in Matthew chapter 17. When Yeshua, verse 24, when Yeshua came to Capernaum, the collectors of the temple tax came to Peter and said, "Your teacher pays the temple tax, doesn't he?" What kind of leading question is that? Your teacher pays the temple tax, doesn't he? By the way, throughout most of the Gospels, those that do not recognize Messiah would most often called him teacher. Your teacher, your rabbi, pays the temple tax, doesn't he? And verse 25, Peter said, yes. I wonder what was going through his head. Can I say no? Is that allowed? My teacher is a good, observant Jewish man. Of course he pays the temple tax. You know, yes, we're poor, but we still pay the temple tax. Now when Peter came into the house, Yeshua spoke to him, saying, "What do you think, Shimon?" By the way, Yeshua, except on one occasion, always called him Shimon, Simon. Only once ever did he call him Peter. But because he once used that nickname, the name stuck. But I found it amazing one time as I searched through the four Besorot, to discover that Yeshua always called him Shimon. He says, "What do you think, Simon? The kings of the earth, from whom do they collect the tolls or taxes? From their sons or from strangers? Who gives to the kings of the earth for taxes? Is it their sons or is it the people that they conquer?" And Peter said, "From the strangers." So Yeshua said to him, "The sons are exempt. But so that we don't offend them, go to the sea." By the way, Capernaum is right on the Kinneret. If you've been to Israel, you can literally walk out of the place that is the traditional house of Peter. You know, they didn't find a stone that says this is Shimon Kefa's house. But there is a place not too far from the beach that is designated. By the way, it's right next door to the synagogue. I mean, that's appropriate. We can find the synagogue right there that Yeshua, the remains of the actual synagogue from the first century is right there. And you can see the synagogue that Yeshua worshipped and prayed in, where he lived there in Capernaum at Peter's house. So here Yeshua is at Peter's house. Yeshua says, "So that we don't offend them, go to the sea," just go down here to the beach, "and throw out a hook and take the first fish that you catch, open its mouth, and you will find a coin. Take that, give it to them for me and you." I find this story intriguing on numerous levels. Let me highlight a couple of them before I get to the connection with what we've set up so far. First, Yeshua is an observant Jew who though he did not associate with the temple and its structure, and though at other times he actually comes against it, and those that are in charge of it, the Sadducees, he reserves the absolute strongest language for them, actually more than the Pharisees, believe it or not. He has more confrontation, more direct antagonism for the Sadducees, not the Pharisees. And this time he says, however, we are not going to offend them. Yeshua is concerned about his social and religious obligations. He is concerned about Peter's social and religious obligations. On another level, he makes this amazing statement. He says, he asks Peter, you know, who do leaders collect taxes from? Is it the sons? Or is it outsiders, people that they conquer? And Peter says, well, of course, I'm a student of history. I know that it's outsiders that they collect taxes from. We see that with the Romans very dramatically, I'm sure Peter, Shimon Kepha thought. And Yeshua says, that's right. The sons are free. Who are the sons in this story? I will argue that the sons Yeshua is thinking of is actually not merely those that embrace him, but those whom God called sons, that is, the children of Israel. The Jewish people are God's children. Israel is God's firstborn, we see in the book of Exodus. Yeshua was arguing Israel is free. We've experienced the Exodus from Egypt. But so that we do not offend, we will pay the temple tax. And this leads to a whole other discussion that's beyond the scope we have here, which is there are times that though we have the right to certain things, or we have the right to certain privileges, we give those up. Yeshua told Peter, we have a right not to pay this. But in the same sentence, Yeshua says, this isn't where we walk in offense. This is a privilege issue, not a kingdom of God issue. Remember that as you walk out your life in your ethics, in your values, in your relationships with people. What is a personal privilege issue, and what is a kingdom of God issue? And that will help us make decisions. I like the way Yeshua points us in that direction. I think it's also interesting that that Peter went down and caught a fish. By the way, you can, to this day, go to any restaurant around the Kinneret and have tilapia, St. Peter's fish, they call it there. I don't know if it comes with a coin in its mouth or not. But Peter gets a coin. I thought it was interesting that one coin sufficed for both Yeshua and Peter. After all, the half shekel later became an actual coin. You couldn't pay a full shekel for just yourself. Two people had to go together to give that coin that Peter found in the fish's mouth. That one coin covered them both. It united them both. It brought them both into a relationship as, yes, they paid the temple tax. But I see it in a greater way. It brought them into relationship. one Becca for each of them. Just as the half shekel was a wedding present from Isaac to Rivka in that gold ring. Oh, by the way, we still do that to this day, don't we? We still follow Isaac's example in giving rings. So also the children of Israel, when they gave that Becca each to God for the building of the tabernacle, it united them with God in relationship. I want to take and carry that same idea into this story in Matthew 17. I think the point is not about paying taxes to the Romans, which I don't think this story is about. And it's quite possible that Matthew was writing to a Messianic Jewish community after the destruction of the temple. And so Yeshua's words about paying the temple tax would have, on some level, been irrelevant because there was no temple at the time that Matthew was writing. But that also is not the issue. The issue is that this symbolizes relationship. That half shekel is a symbol of a relationship between Peter and the Most High, between Peter and Yeshua, his Messiah. By the way, it was just the chapter before that when Peter said, "You are Messiah," in chapter 16 of Matthew. Now Peter makes the half shekel payment, bringing him into relationship with the Most High. I think it's ironic that Yeshua actually provides the coin for Peter to be in relationship with Yeshua. Are you following my story? Yeshua is the one that provided the miracle. You know, go down, catch a fish, you'll find a coin in its mouth for us both, for you to be joined together with me, for you to be brought together in a half shekel relationship with me. Yeshua provided the way for Peter to enter into that, if you want to call it, wedding relationship, like Isaac and Rivka. The same remains true for us today. What will we give? What is our heart drawing us to? There is a relationship with the Most High. There is a relationship with the Creator of the universe waiting to unify us as a community, just as Israel was unified as a community to build the tabernacle. What will we provide to be married in a covenant relationship with the Most High? And then my second application. Yeshua provides the wedding gift. Yeshua provided that wedding gift for Peter to go down and find that coin. Yeshua has provided for us in his teachings, in his life, in his execution, in his resurrection. We have entered into intimate relationship and worship with the Most High because Yeshua has paid the half shekel. It should mean that we dedicate ourselves, not run from that relationship, not try to get out of it or go after something else like Israel did in the wilderness with that golden calf incident. Yeshua is our bridegroom. He's paid the half shekel.